From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later, yes, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Seattle police are hunting for a driver and a passenger who fired shots at a car carrying a one-year-old, hitting the infant in the face, leaving her clinging to life in an apparent case of road rage. She was struck by one of the five bullets fired into her family's car by a stranger after adults in her family got into a dispute with another driver in the Seattle suburb of Kent. The toddler, who was strapped in her car seat in the back of a family silver Chevrolet Impala, was initially reported dead, but officials said she's fighting for her life. Very sad story there. Around 59,000 people die every year from rabies transmitted by dogs, with the poorer regions of the world affected worst, according to a report by the Global Alliance for Rabies Control. The report authors said that there should be more done to vaccinate dogs, particularly in low-income countries. Rabies is a fatal viral infection, which is almost 100% preventable. The infection can infect all mammals, but domestic dogs cause more than 99% of all human deaths from the rabies. Well, they call him a quack. 10 doctors and critics say Dr. Oz is a quack. The group of nationally known doctors, in a letter to his university, called for the TV doctor's dismissal from the prestigious post of vice chairman of Columbia University's Department of Surgery. Dr. Henry Miller of Stanford says, he's a quack. He's a fake. He's a charlatan. I think I know the motivation at Columbia, he said. He said they're starstruck. They like having someone on their faculty that is one of the best-known doctors in the world. But the fact is that his advice endangers patients, and this doesn't seem to faze them. That's a big problem, because Dr. Oz is a doctor, but he's into holistic medicine too. Researchers at the University of Miami have found that an over-the-counter supplement is effective in preventing and treating prostate cancer. The supplement is called 4-MU. It's a non-toxic oral agent used as a dietary supplement in Europe and Asia for improving liver health. Treating mice with the supplement appeared to inhibit prostate cancer from further developing, starting as soon as 8 weeks after the rodents were diagnosed with it. What's going up in the skies these days? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do we have going on?
Well, good evening, George. It's nice to be back. I had a delightful time at the Ozark conference, UFO conference, this past week. They did a wonderful job of organizing it, and that's a conference I recommend everybody consider attending every year. Lots going on.
Sure is.
I think the last time I made an appearance on Coast was the 4th of April, Friday night, and just about the time that program was beginning, there was a very interesting sighting in Los Baños, California. An adult female, her young son, and her niece were walking down a road, she writes, a road in Los Baños, and they looked out into the middle of the road off to the side of them, and there was a transparent ball of light, about 3 feet in diameter, she reports, had enough feature on it so she could tell it was spinning at apparently high speed. Suddenly, after about 10 or 20 seconds, she estimates, the thing just disappeared. Have no idea what that thing was, but it's reminiscent of a report I gave last November about a hunter who had a small red object approach him while he was sitting in a deer stand in Gilson, Illinois. Well, Monday of this week in New River, Arizona, husband and wife were driving down a road, and husband looked up. He saw five blue lights approaching their car at high speed, commented to his wife. He said those planes were going to collide with one another. They were so tightly packed in a formation. This is nighttime now. And suddenly the light started doing a zigzag, a coordinated zigzag maneuver in the night sky. They suddenly split up and went in all different directions. Very, very interesting report. The next night, the 14th of April, that makes it, I guess, that would make it Tuesday night. got a very interesting report from Dalton, New Hampshire, way up in the northern reaches of New Hampshire, very close to the area where Betty and Barney Hill were abducted back in September of 1961, I believe it was. People saw five golden lights hovering in the night sky. Suddenly, they heard the exhaust of loud, they think, military fighter aircraft approaching these five objects. The five objects split up and disappeared in different directions. Very interesting report. And about 2.5 hours later, got a very interesting report from a gentleman in Kamloops, British Columbia, just north of where I am. He said that he and his wife were in a hot tub looking at the beautiful night sky. Suddenly, they saw four satellite-like objects, nose to tail, go right over their head, heading east. Took the objects about 30 seconds to go from directly overhead to gone over the eastern horizon. Very, very interesting sighting. And a similar one, about 5 minutes after I hung up the phone with that gentleman, I got a call from a gentleman in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, just east of Spokane. Saw something very similar, except he saw two white lights that covered about 80 degrees of arc, he estimated, in 4 seconds. Very, very rapid across the night sky. And final report comes from Niagara Falls. This is last night. Gentleman was standing outside looking at a beautiful night sky, looked to the south, and he saw a shimmering red light approaching his position. He reports that it looked very similar to a road flare. To his amazement, it suddenly dropped out a white light that was visible only for about a second. Then the original red light split into two. Now it's a red light and a white light sitting beside each other. They suddenly swap colors. The red light becomes white, the white light becomes red, and it continued going to the north. George, I tell you, there's some very, very strange things that are taking place on this planet. I feel privileged to share them with the Coast audience.
Well, you keep watching those skies for us, Peter. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, a playwright with a long fascination with the supernatural. Jeffrey Stanley joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Playwright, screenwriter, NYU faculty Jeffrey Stanley is the author of the hit play Tesla's Letters. Now, he regularly performs his autobiographical supernatural comic monologue. It's called Boneyards in Philadelphia and New York City. We'll talk about that as well. He's got a fascination, a lifelong fascination with the unusual, with the supernatural. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome along.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good. Looking forward to this. Tell me about your playwright career. I always find that fascinating.
So, absolutely. I grew up in southwestern Virginia and went to NYU to go to film school and eventually went back to a dramatic writing program there, which is playwriting and screenwriting. And so got very interested in both worlds very much. And in about 1999, I was just finishing up with college, and a play that I had written called Tesla's Letters got produced off-Broadway in New York, and it was a strange play at the time. We weren't sure how it was going to do, but it wound up doing extremely well, and so it made me make the decision to stay in New York and pursue playwriting. I still do a lot of screenwriting as well, but mostly I'm more interested in theater, which is kind of why I decided to be a New York type instead of an L.A. type.
Now, what kind of pushed you, Jeffrey, into the supernatural realm?
It's kind of funny. I was, people had Ouija boards when I was growing up. You know, my cousin had one, and, you know, we'd mess around with it now and then for 5 minutes, and I don't think we really understood what to do with it, and not much happened with it. But when I was 19, something happened that really blew my mind, and that's really what got me started on this crazy course. So I was at a party with a few friends. It was New Year's Eve. You know, we're 19, we're teenagers. And the party had wound down. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And we're all sitting around the candlelit kitchen table in the dark. And, you know, the mood was right for the conversation to turn towards seances. Somebody said, "Too bad we don't have a Ouija board." And somehow, I don't know why exactly, instinctively I knew what to do. This had never occurred to me before. I asked for a blank sheet of paper. Robin brought me one. I wrote the letters A to Z, yes and no, numbers 1 through 10. We tried a couple of different things for a planchette, you know, a coin, mm-hmm. overturned teacup. We finally settled on a credit card, which was great because the raised letters gave it a very small surface area. So an upside-down credit card was great. One corner, we designated the pointer. And my friends, Adam, Marietta, Scott, I still keep in touch with these people, sat around it. Each of them put just one finger gently on it, and I stood aside. I didn't touch the board for a while, and
yeah.
I was going to ask the questions, and I said something like, "We come here tonight in a spirit of peace to make new friends. Is there anyone out there who'd like to speak with us?" And at this point, we really weren't taking it that seriously at all, and right away it started to move, you know, and it went from A to Z, A to Z, over and over again. And growing up in the Bible Belt, right away I thought Alpha and the Omega. I am mm-hmm. the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, you know, which are the words of Christ. And I said, "Oh, really? You're Jesus Christ?" And it said, "Yes." Now, not that I think that that's what was going on. You know, I think that whatever was going on was something that was messing with us. But, you know, I feel like, too, when you throw open the door, I've learned through many years of experience with this now, whenever you get an iconic historical figure, question it. You know, you're going to get Jesus, Satan, Mark Twain. You know, those are to be taken with a grain of salt. But the next question I always ask, and I've come to ask, is where are you now? You know, are you in the room with us now? Is often a good question to ask. And the answer I've gotten so many times over the years is Zion, Zion, which is, you know, an old 19th century term for heaven taken from the Hebrew Bible. And so that's sort of always had this archaic feel to me. And there's an old hymn, "We're marching to Zion, beautiful Zion, the beautiful city of God." So I never quite knew what to make of that, but it's an answer that I've gotten a lot. And so, you know, the board started really cooking. And first we were still just joking around. I'd point to my friend Scott and say, "How old is Scott?" And the board would get it right. "How old is Adam?" The board would get it right. And pretty soon we start getting bored with just watching it guess ages. And so I say, "Are you in the room with us now?" It says, "Yes." And I say, "Can you see us?" It says, "Yes." And again, still being very flip and being 19, I said, "Can you see our underwear?" And it said, "Yes." And I said, "All right." We're all laughing, just like you are. And I said, "All right, I'm wearing boxer shorts. They're white. They have stripes. What color are the stripes?" And it spelled out red. And now I was not touching the board. And holy cow, I pulled out the waistband of my boxers. My stripes are red. Everybody laughs.
Jeez.
I point to my, and it starts out funny, but it takes a turn. I point to my friend Adam. "What color underwear is Adam wearing?" And it spells out white. He pulls up the waistband of his underwear. They're white. "What color underwear is Marietta wearing?" It spells out blue. She pulls up the waistband of her underwear. They're blue. Everybody's laughing. "What color underwear is Scott wearing?" And it spells out UGLY. And he pulls up the waistband of his boxers. They're black and orange plaid. Everybody howls.
Yeah.
Now, looking back, it's like they were setting us up. You know, they wanted us to let our guards down. That's what it seems like in retrospect. Because that takes a turn here. My friend Adam is there. He wants to talk to Jimi Hendrix. Now, Adam's a big guitar virtuoso. He's still a good friend of mine. His name's Adam Markham. I'm sure he's listening tonight. He's a well-respected member of the community, a very level-headed guy. And so his guitar is there on the floor in its open case. We've been playing Christmas songs and things on it earlier. He really wants to talk to Jimi Hendrix. So we trade places. Now, I don't know anything about Jimi Hendrix, not really, you know, just the basic. I gave him a couple of his songs.
He was one heck of a guitar player, Jeff.
Yeah, I can say that about him. That's about all I knew about him at that point. So we trade places. I sit down and touch the credit card. Adam stands up to ask the questions. And he says, "Are you there, Jimmy?" And it says, "Yes." And he starts asking Jimmy all these biographical questions, and the board's getting them right. And Adam is amazed. And he's asking obscure questions like what year Jimmy was born, what year certain albums came out, who sat in on certain sessions. Jimmy's getting every question right. And then Adam drops the bomb and says, "Jimmy, can you play my guitar?" And we all fall silent, and it says yes. And he says, "All you have to do is pluck one of my guitar strings, Jimmy. Can you do that?" and it shoots to yes. And I mean, it shoots with such force. People who use Ouija boards will know what I mean. It flies off the paper sometimes. We put it back on, we touch it again, it shoots back to yes and keeps circling it faster and faster in tight little loops. And then out of nowhere, I kid you not, Robin's little black kitten comes running in from the dark living room, makes a beeline for his guitar and starts smacking at one of the strings. And so everybody freaked. Marietta's up flipping on all the lights. Robin's yelling at me, going, "I hate you, Jeff Stanley. I was never scared of this house before, and now you've made it haunted."
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to do. I was completely freaked out also. And in the middle of all that, we start smelling something burning. And it smells kind of pleasant. It smells like a fireplace. And the problem is Robin ain't got no fireplace.
Uh-huh.
So we start sniffing, going, "What is that?" And we go into the living room, and their freaking Christmas tree is on fire.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh. Now, they had a little red-scented candle that, you know, like a Christmas decoration.
Yep.
Somehow.
The needles were dry, right?
It got knocked over. All of this molten wax was running across the table onto the tree, setting it aflame.
Ugh.
And we got it out. And, you know, I went in the kitchen, balled up the Ouija board, threw it in the trash, said, "I'm never doing that again." And that lasted about 6 months, and then I was doing it again. So, you know, it was too amazing for me to put away, really. I mean, to put what had happened away. And so as bizarre as that was, it got me launched, you know, into this, into Ouija boards. It was a while before I started thinking about working it into a performance and how I moved from that to the spirit box. But, you know, I did it a lot through college. I would make Ouija boards at parties and things. And then in 2001, after Tesla's letters happened, I was a Copeland Fellow at Amherst College. I was sort of a visiting scholar for a semester there. And one day I walk into the college library, and there under glass, as though like waiting for me, was a giant homemade Ouija board with a teacup for a planchette. And it turned out it was James Merrill's Ouija board, and he's you know, major American poet, died in the early 90s, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know he wrote a book called The Changing Light at Sandover. It's an epic poem that he wrote using
That's
a Ouija
right.
board. You know, he and his partner David did it over a period of years. So that re-inspired me, reignited me, and I spent that a semester in New England there running around the campus and the woods around the campus with a couple of friends, playing with Ouija boards. And so it was sort of a long, slow burn, you know, getting me to where I am now with continuing to use it.
What a great story. Now, from that first episode, did you continue regularly to use the Ouija board, or did you stop and then come back to it years later?
I stopped and came back to it, not years later. It's like 6 months would go by, I would do it again. You know, 6 more months would go by, I would do it again. You know, it was sort of always there lurking in the background. I finally purchased a Ouija board, although it's still more fun to make your own. And I've gotten into collecting a couple of them. You know, I belong to Robert Murch's talking board group. You know, he's a friend. And so I have an old, a 1917 antique Ouija board that I use in the shows that I do. So it was a long, slow burn to the point that I'm using them as frequently as I am now, but it never fully left me.
At any point, did you feel as if you had demons coming through or anything evil?
Yes, or at least naughty. I mean, you know, I think that over the years I've been doing this, I've kind of developed, I can talk more about this later, I hope, a worldview about what I think is going on with the afterlife. And
yeah,
I'm sure it's not perfect. It's
going
to have holes in it. But I do have a sort of picture that works for me. But, yeah, there are certainly hostile spirits. I think I've encountered hostile more than evil. I feel like I once had a ghost of a child attach herself to me for a few months. But I found a loving home and dropped her off somewhere. And I've never had anything that I felt was evil. I mean, anything that was naughty or evil or just hostile. The good thing about a Ouija board is you just stop the session, you know, stop doing it. You know, or I always warn people, if they've never done it before, look, if you're highly suggestible, don't do it. It's not a contest. If you're afraid to do this, don't do it. You know, and or if anything weird happens, just lift your fingers.
In the wrong hands, it could be a problem, right? I would think.
I think so. And I think, too, I mean, even if you take it as, let's say there's nothing supernatural about it, it's subconscious ideomotor impulses. I mean, if you're tapping into your own subconscious, and you've had a bad day and the Ouija board says, kill your boss.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're highly suggestible. You're not maybe not going to go kill your boss, but you'll decide that it was an evil presence telling you to do it.
Jeffrey, stay with us. We're going to come back, take this quick break. Jeffrey Stanley with us as we're talking about his work on the other side, and we're going to get right into it when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Jeffrey Stanley with us. Jeffrey, we're talking about the possibility of some evil coming through with Ouija boards. I don't use them. Much like you, I'm not concerned about myself. I was going to do years ago a Ouija board experiment on the show, and I canceled it because I thought, you know what, this could really affect other people somehow, and I don't want to take that responsibility. Well, I had a lot of people who wanted me to go through with it. They were having pizza parties, a Ouija pizza party. They were all excited about it, and I backed out, and they kind of went ballistic. But I don't think it's a toy.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's a toy either. No, I mean, I started out thinking it was. I don't think it's a toy. I think it's something very serious. I can only speak for myself and people in my immediate circle that I know directly who've also used Ouija boards. I've never had anything happen that was what I would call evil or demonic. I've never encountered that except in movies. You know, I feel like there's a lot of hype around that, and I feel like you have a lot more control with the Ouija board than maybe people think that you do. You know, it's so easy to just walk away and not use it again if it troubles you. I've never had anything that made me feel like, boy, I never want to do this again, put it that way.
You were talking about what you think is happening on the other side. Why don't you explain that? Give me your thoughts, your views.
Sure, I can talk a little bit about it. So, you know, I've been almost my entire life kind of a student of religion. I mean, I grew up in southwestern Virginia in, you know, pretty Christian atmosphere. But even at a young age, I was sort of drawn to I was very curious kid. So, you know, I was very interested growing up in Eastern religion. And, you know, I got into Madame Blavatsky, and I got into the Beatles. I learned about the word karma, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And then when I was in 11th grade, actually, I think it was 11th grade, William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist, you probably know about this. He was on Letterman and talked about Breakthrough, An Amazing Study in Electronic Communication with the Dead by Konstantin Raudive, which I know you know about because I've read your book, Talking to the Dead. So, and he played some EVPs on Letterman. And so that stuck in the back of my mind, too. It was years before I would start trying that stuff myself. But, all this stuff kind of culminated. And, you know, jumping ahead, I mean, I've been to India a few times now. I've traveled around the country. Through my interest in Hinduism, I started learning about Tibetan Buddhism, which is an offshoot of that. And I've been to a lot of Buddhist monasteries up around northern India. And so as a result of all of that, that led to my reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which frequently these days goes by a little more of a user-friendly title, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which is a little less morbid sounding, probably a little more accurate. But, you know, when I look at all the major religions and I'm looking for something to explain what I've personally experienced over years, that one nails it, or comes closest, to put it that way. So I put a lot of stock in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, or the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and that book really speaks to me. And so, to give you a quick snapshot of that worldview, it's, there's a place where you go when you die called the Bardo, B-A-R-D-O. You go there temporarily between incarnations. Sometimes people get stuck there out of their own earthbound attachments, their own fear of moving forward, and they're kind of stuck hanging around there in an unhealthy state of, you know, morbid obsession, morbid self-obsession, afraid to move forward. And so that explains very well. It jives very well with what I feel like the spirits themselves have communicated to me over the years.
Do you think when the universe was formed, Jeffrey, that somehow this realm was created first and then everything else was, created afterward?
Yeah, I don't know if I feel that way. I mean, my impression is that other part, at least another realm existed first, and this physical realm came second, next.
By design?
Yeah, I think by design, yes.
I do too. It's too complicated.
Yeah, yes, I agree. I believe there is a design at work.
I just wish we could get the answers to that. You know, the simple answer is it's God, and then you just leave it alone. But I need more than that, don't you?
Oh yeah, and you know, but and then there is, you know, there's a, I think there's a valid, you know, my wife's uncle in India is very against the fact that I do this stuff, and he always has said to me on more than one occasion, there's a reason God has kept these realms separate. There are certain things you're not supposed to know for your own good until you're gone, and you know, by trying to open a door between these two worlds, you're going to get yourself into trouble. So yes, you know, it would be nice to have answers, and I think we've all as humans got extreme curiosity. I mean, it's what has made us explore and put us on the moon, and this is one more thing to explore, you know.
Well, with Jeffrey Stanley, playwright, screenwriter, I guess those are the best titles for you, aren't they?
Yeah, I like that, yes.
And tell me then about what is called the Amtrak Writer's Residency.
Yeah, so that was very fun. I mean, over the years, I've done, you know, I'll get, you know, sometimes something happens, something interesting to me happens, or I experience something, and I think that would make a great play, or I think that would make a great movie script. I'm going to write that and try to sell it. Once in a while, I think that would make a great first-person piece in the New York Times. I'm going to write that and try to make that happen. And so, you know, I'm a voracious reader, and, you know, so I do have a lot of wheels spinning. And so a few years ago, I wrote a few pieces for the Washington Post that were of a spiritual first-person nature. One of them happened to me on a train. And so, so that's just a little bit of backstory, because what happened is about a year and a half ago, a novelist named Alexander Chi was giving an interview about one of his latest novels, and he said in passing that he had written a lot of the novel while commuting on a train, and he jokingly said, yeah, Amtrak should have a writer's residency. And so a lot of people started tweeting Amtrak saying, how about it? And so Amtrak said, all right, we'll do it. And so basically they had a contest. It was for, you know, they wanted, let's say, mid-career, you know, established writers with a strong social media presence and a certain things they were after. And it was actually my wife, because I had written this train piece, who's told me about it first and said, this is for you. You've got to apply for this thing. So, and everyone I knew was applying for it, and it was easy to do. So, they, out of 16,000 applicants, they picked 24 writers, and I was lucky to be one of the 24. And I'm the only dramatist in the group, as far as I know. And so it was great. The PR from that was great. It was very nice for all of us. But the real prize was, we each got to pick the route of our choice and take a cross-country trip to be alone and do nothing but write in a private room for, you know, let's say up to 2 weeks. And so I chose the California Zephyr because my criteria was I wanted to choose a train that went through a part of the U.S. with which I was least familiar. And so for me, that was kind of generally the northwest area of the country. So yeah, I picked the California Zephyr and went on this 12-day odyssey back in March.
You know, the work that you've been doing professionally and on the other side, basically, is fantastic. And when you were doing all of this, did you ever come across anything that, you know, concerned you in terms of the paranormal, the Ouija board, or did you just, you know, forge ahead?
You're talking about on the train ride?
On everything that you've been doing in this arena.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm kind of a magnet for it. You know, that was the origin of some of the pieces I wrote for the Washington Post. You know, I feel like partly I've got my eyes open for it, maybe. You know, I feel like anything that is in the, anything supernatural seems to find me, you know, and so I'm one of those people I feel like who can walk into a building and tell you right away whether it's haunted or not. And, you know, it's something that's always with me, even when, you know, I write about a lot of things. It's not always related to the supernatural, but, you know, it's always in the back of my mind, though. It's sort of become an inescapable part of my existence.
You've got another stage show called Boneyards.
Yeah.
Tell me about this one, because that's kind of supernatural, comical, and very weird.
Yeah, That's one of the more unusual things I do. So aside from writing, I sometimes perform. You know, it's usually called performance art because I'm not really acting. I'm not playing another person. I'm playing me. And it's autobiographical. And but there's certainly some theatrics involved. And so the show usually takes place in the coal cellar of a 120-year-old storefront synagogue here in South Philly. And so I grew up, as I put it, I grew up Southern Gothic. I spent a big part of my childhood living next door to a funeral home in a small town in rural southwestern Virginia. And so, in fact, the funeral home owners owned our house. They were our landlords. And no one had lived in the house for a while, and they weren't used to having tenants around, and especially kids. And so, you know, there were all these storage sheds on the property where they kept the funeral home supplies, like stretchers, jars of formaldehyde, and I would run around in and out of these shacks whenever I felt like it. And even then, I started realizing there was like a public part of the funeral home in this sort of, I always said I was backstage at the funeral home, seeing all of this stuff. And then I had an upstairs bedroom, and it was, pretty isolated. There was nothing to do out there. Like my grandmother always said, we're so far out, the sun had to be piped in.
Granny.
Yeah, that's right. And so there we are. You know, I had nothing to do but watching the funeral home kind of became my hobby. So I could go upstairs at night, and I had a telescope, you know, like a little Kmart telescope, like you could look at the moon with. But like just 30 yards away across the grass, I could look right into the embalming room and watch them embalm the body.
Oh, my God.
And just from the chest up, kind of a medium shot, but I could see them washing the hair, putting on the makeup, getting it dressed. And I could see when they brought new bodies in. So it was sort of like circle of life. You know, I would see a body come in on a stretcher out of a cargo van and into the funeral home. And then that night I'd see it. I'd wonder who it was. They'd be under a sheet. Oh, it's an old man. It's a woman, whatever. And then day or two after that, parking lot's full of cars. There's a funeral. The hearse drives away. Everybody follows it. Empty parking lot. It's quiet again. A couple days later, the whole thing repeats. So I was kind of getting this life lesson, you know, at an early age. And, you know, my grandmother was very morbid, too. I mean, she was funny. She had a great sense of humor. But she's somebody who would, like, we'd stand and peek out together and watch while they brought bodies in. And I so wanted to take a tour of the funeral home. But, you know, I was too little. They wouldn't let me. I was, like, 11 or 12. But I can remember coming home from school one day and my grandmother going, I got to go, and telling me. The funeral home director's wife showed her around inside the funeral home, and she was telling me all about the embalming room. So it was just kind of like this, you know, I don't know, fact of existence that I had. And, you know, so I tell some of those stories, and about my kind of, you know, growing up, I kind of became a taphophile, a person who loves cemeteries. You know, I'm a cemetery tourist. I love stopping in old cemeteries and taking pictures, and that's sort of separate, in a way, from the supernatural thing. So, but the supernatural element starts to come into it and, you know, culminates in my asking the audience to have a seance with me at the end of the show. And it's a real earnest attempt to contact the dead. So, there's a Ouija board. I get two or three volunteers to help with that. I also have a PSB7 spirit box. I turn that on. We record that. And, you know, sometimes nothing great happens, nothing worthwhile happens, let's say, but then other times something mind-blowing happens, and it runs the gamut, you know, and it's a small show. I keep it to 20 seats max. It's a very intimate sort of
experience. Oh, it is. It sure is.
Yeah, yeah.
But it works. It works for you, and it probably works for the audience, too.
Yeah, I think so. And, I mean, it's not really, there is certainly a creepiness element, but I don't really see it as just like a sort of a Halloween haunted house kind of show. It definitely is a lot more philosophical than that, and I hope it makes the audience think and hopefully, you know, value their own lives a little more, too, when they leave. And maybe also just be a little more prepared for their own mortality, I hope, because I think that's on the back of all of our minds, really, just as human beings. And so I think it's partly about just facing that and dealing with it.
When you're in that mode and you're able to, you know, dabble with the other side, whether it's through the Ouija board or in a cemetery, is it strange for you? I mean, especially being in a cemetery, do you feel anything, any kind of energy?
You know, I've only very recently, like in the past few months, let's say, decided cemeteries are worth checking into, because my thought before for years had always been, there's no reason to look for ghosts in a cemetery. Why would they hang around there? They're going to be back. If they are here, they're going to be back at their house. They're going to be looking for their loved ones. You know, they're not going to be hanging around a cemetery. So I started, you know, you hear stories once in a while about a certain haunted cemetery or a certain haunted grave in a cemetery. Then I thought, all right, let me run down a couple of those. And one of these was in India, in Kolkata. There's a very famous cemetery there called South Park Street Cemetery. It's an old colonial British cemetery. There's a crypt there called the Denison Family Crypt. And it's also known as the Bleeding Grave, because I've never seen this happen, but supposedly small red droplets of a liquid resembling blood sometimes appear on its surface. When I heard that, I went, all right, I'll do an EVP session there. You know, maybe there's something to that one. And yeah, I got really cool stuff. I mean, really stuff that sounded like, as far as I'm concerned, them, and they're saying the name Denison, and I thought, wow, they really are here. But, you know, the thing is, it's fascinating and exciting, but I really feel sorry for them. They don't need to be there. They need to move along. So, you know, there's sort of an impulse after, once you get over the thrill, or you accept, like, wow, they're really there and they can really communicate, once you get over that hump, I personally start to go, we shouldn't really be talking to them. They shouldn't have to be there. They need to go. You know, that we're talking to them because they haven't moved on.
Jeez. Jeffrey, when we come back from the break, I want to ask you about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, a book I read a very, very long time ago. But give me your thoughts on the mood of the world right now when it comes to trying to understand spirituality and the supernatural and the paranormal. Do you think it's still strong?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, when you look at surveys every so often that pop up, it's usually a majority of people who say, yes, they believe in God, or yes, they believe in a supernatural. I think it's, you know, I find it interesting when, you know, if you said, for example, to a person that you didn't know very well, I believe in God, or I am a devout, you know, pick your religion. I'm a devout Christian. Most people, even if they aren't religious, will just sort of accept that about you and go, okay, well, that's great, that's nice. But if you say, I believe in ghosts, people really sometimes, you know, want to excoriate you for that. And I'm not sure what the difference is between one and the other belief, you know, in terms of having the belief or not. I think it's all interconnected. And I think every religion has some validity to it, kind of like a slice, a piece of the pie. And, you know, so, and sometimes I'm hopeful, because it seems like there's so much more dialogue now between the religions. Sometimes you're, you know, disappointed at when you get into some of the religious violence that's also going on around the world. But, you know, clearly it's still very important to people.
You know, Tesla's Papers, the play that you wrote,
yeah.
It is indeed true that the FBI or some agency seized his papers when he died.
Yes, indeed. And a big part of the play is about the death beam, whether there was one. I mean, it's all within a fictional context. You know, there's a fictional protagonist, an American grad student going to Belgrade and, you know, claiming that she wants to go to the, going to the Tesla Museum, claiming she wants, that she's writing a paper on Tesla's personal life outside the lab, but really she's there to find out about the death ray papers. And, yeah, that's really fascinating stuff. You know, yeah, we took the papers. Let's say the FBI took the papers when he died, and then we held on to them until 52. We held on to them for a decade, gave them to Yugoslavia, but, you know, questions are, did we give them everything? We certainly wouldn't have given them anything we thought was dangerous that could fall into Soviet hands. And even with the FOIA stuff that's out now about Tesla, so much of it's been redacted. It just also raises eyebrows. You know, what are they not telling us? And, you know, absolutely.
That's true. Jeffrey, when we come back, let's talk about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and we'll take some phone calls about the other side next on Coast to Coast AM.